listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Well, Tony, it's been a while, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak with you, and it sure has been very busy in that part of the world, where I just spent a week, by the way, in beautiful La Habana, Cuba.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm especially interested in, Don, because I look at what's going on in Cuba very much from the outside, and is how the process for what many people are calling the transition from the revolutionary generation of the 1950s to a new generation is proceeding. And you've probably had a chance to get a good insight into that.
A little bit, yeah. Apparently, the feeling there is that this has already been accomplished in the main and quite some time ago. So I guess, they anticipated that Fidel would get old, and that the other colleagues from the revolutionary days would get old, and that it's time for the next generation, and they are pretty much in control of things already and have been for a few years now.
Yeah, and the recent elections were a really astonishing exercise in democracy in comparison with what goes on, for example, in Colombia. And I think I'm right in saying that the turnout was over 80% in the Cuban
correct.
Elections.
Yep, that's right.
Whereas in Colombia, it was under 50%.
Right. And in places like Honduras, it doesn't matter what the turnout is and how they vote, because whoever they want, the United States wants to be in power is who wins, regardless of the actual count.
Yeah, or in Haiti or in any of those countries where U.S. Regimes dominate.
Well, if you win in Haiti, I think you get to reside in the Central African Republic. I think that's where the presidential palace is for Haiti if you happen to win. Yeah.
Well, So yeah, it's really good to know that Cuba is making progress with its political and economic system, because you also mentioned that in a conversation that we had a little earlier that Cuba is making good progress in getting rid of its anomalous dual currency system. So that's good news too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, they had set up this dual currency to accommodate the tourism that began in earnest about, you know, over the last decade, and the anticipation of seeing tourism from the U.S., which began a couple of years ago, in substantial terms. I mean, there's a couple of flights out of New York every day direct to Havana from JFK, and on JetBlue, there's also flights from Atlanta and Miami on, you know, like daily back and forth. And they're pretty full. And you see people from Canada, EU, Australia, lots of folks from China and Japan. There were two Japanese families in the house that I was staying in. And so they, you know, as this, you know, influx of people from around the world came in, you had the economic conditions on the ground were, you know, the consequence of, at the time, 50-some-odd years of embargo. What they did was establish a currency that was exchangeable for hard currency, but was a Cuban currency. In other words, you can't spend dollars. You have to buy the Cuban exchange currency, and then you can buy these things that, you know, that are available to tourists because this currency, like what they call the CUC, or the Cuban unit of currency, which is this exchange currency, is 24 Cuban pesos, which is the country's actual currency. So you've had like a dual track of goods and services available, sort of analogous to what they had in the Soviet Union and some of the Warsaw Pact countries back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in the Beryozka stores, where, you know, anybody can go in and buy it, but you have to have hard currency, and since no one will exchange hard currency for pesos, foreigners had preference. Now, there was a decision to do that in order to induce tourism, and apparently that's been so successful that they are now going to, basically unify the currency so there aren't two. There are contradictions because you have, like we had in the Soviet Union at that time, in a country where the housing is free, all of the necessities of life are free or very cheap, wages and the public policy is equality. The wage difference between, say, a clerk in a store and the person running a teaching hospital, not a substantial wage difference. Where in the United States, it might be this one makes $25,000 a year and this one $2 million. You know, there it's much closer. And the thing that happened with this currency is that suddenly taxi drivers are making, you know, 10 or 50 times as much because they're getting paid in hard currency as, say, medical doctors, surgeons, lawyers, you know, et cetera. Their contradictions like that are now under discussion and action in order to sort of attempt to resolve all of it as they do this currency thing. But I was told by an authoritative figure that the currency situation is expected to be taken care of over the next months.
Right. And obviously all this is a result of the United States embargo and boycott against Cuba.
That's right.
And just as it was in the days of the 1980s here in Nicaragua, when the same kinds of contradictions arose here in Nicaragua directly as a result of the United States government boycott and sanctions, economic sanctions. Right. And talking about that, maybe we should start talking about Venezuela.
For sure, because they're going through, you know, the similar, you know, consequences. Essentially, what we're talking about is, since the Cuban Revolution, the United States has conducted economic warfare against Cuba. And since the coup in 2002, but really since 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected, the U.S. has been conducting economic warfare against Venezuela as well, with the full cooperation and or, you know, the instruction from the United States, the action of the local bourgeoisie.
Yeah, and the most decisive decision in the current phase of the United States economic war and also diplomatic, media, and to some extent military war,
right,
because of the military preparations that the Southern Command is making in the case of a U.S. intervention in Venezuela, which right. they always portray as humanitarian, like they did in Libya and right. Iraq and everywhere else. And the decisive moment was Barack Obama's decision to declare Venezuela back in 2015 as a threat to the security of the United States.
I know.
And Donald Trump has taken a couple of decisions to intensify that over the first couple of years of his presidency. And one the latest decision by President Trump in the United States government's economic war against Venezuela was the decision to sanction any U.S. citizen who engages in transactions involving Venezuela's new cryptocurrency, the Petro.
Right.
Because of the very nature of the Petro as a cryptocurrency, it's going to be very difficult for the United States authorities to police that decision by President Trump. And the Petro itself has been, extremely successful in its launch and in its pre-sale phase. It had something over $5 billion worth of offers to buy the Petro.
Not bad.
And currently a delegation is in Moscow at a conference about the technology, the so-called blockchain technology, on which all the cryptocurrencies are based. And I've always been quite skeptical about the cryptocurrencies, because it's not clear to me that the advantages of the blockchain chain technology warrant all the hype that has especially grown up around, for example, the Bitcoin. But I can see that the way the Venezuelan government is implementing that blockchain technology is significantly different from Bitcoin, because they have real resources with which to back up its value, namely oil and minerals,
yep.
Including gold.
Yep.
Recently there was an announcement that Venezuela, I've forgotten, it has enormous, they just made this announcement that Venezuela does have enormous gold reserves.
Right.
Gold in the ground.
Right.
So, you know, and let's see how that pans out. And so far it looks as though the Petro is going to be in internal terms of Venezuela's economy. It looks as though the Petro will be a viable alternative that will make it much harder for outside manipulators who try and arbitrage an artificial value of the Venezuelan currency, the Bolivar, via websites like Dollar Today.
Right.
In conjunction with the Colombian authorities, who have allowed their the private foreign exchange dealers all along the Venezuelan border to fix an artificial value
right.
Of the Colombian currency against the Venezuelan currency. So
yeah, they're trying to sink the Venezuelan currency. This is warfare. Exactly.
So and the Petro, it looks as though the Petro is going to, it's not a complete solution by any means, but it's a sufficiently significant solution to make a big difference in terms of Venezuela's domestic economy. And we'll see how that pans out over the next 3, 4, 5 months.
Yeah, you know, you've got an interesting context for this also, because Monday, China started offering Petro Yuan on the markets in Shanghai, the International Energy Exchange. In other words, a Petro Chinese currency backed by China's gold. Now, you're talking with oil. There's an annual trade value of about $14 trillion, which is roughly equivalent to China's gross domestic product last year.
So they're much less than the U.S. GDP.
Okay, and so the potential there is enormous.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so, and you can see that, you can see the way that Russia and China are trading their energy transactions in their national currencies, the ruble and the yuan.
That's right.
You're finding that Iran is able to has been able to successfully defeat U.S. sanctions, and it's also working very closely with China and Russia, not just on the diplomatic front, but very much on the economic front as well. Pakistan has just made an announcement that it's not going to engage in any aggression against Iran, you know, which is, right. You know. So the diplomatic, economic, and financial fronts are obviously very much interrelated, and it's whereas in the rest of Latin America, superficially it looks as though the regional elites that are allied with the U.S. government are very much in the ascendancy for the moment. Now, in the overall global position is that a multipolar world has already emerged.
That's right.
And is well on its way to setting up financial economic structures that will render the U.S. ascendancy or dominance, the United States government, and kind of vicariously its allies in Western Europe, they've enjoyed for ever since the end of the Second World War, and that is now definitely over. And you can see, and I was writing about this in an article yesterday, you can see how while the regional elites here in Latin America are determined to follow the models, the failed models of their North American and European patrons, and they also have to accommodate, and we've talked about this in many conversations over the last few months, they also have to accommodate their own greedy interests as regional elites, but also their country's own national interests, with the reality that China is now the dominant global economic power.
Right.
And I don't think it's premature to say that.
I don't either.
Because if it were not the case, and President Trump wouldn't be trying to start a trade war with China in a desperate attempt to protect America's commercial position in the world. You know? Mm-hmm. So then, going back to Venezuela, and what you can see there is that in that global context that you've just pointed out, and the situation in Venezuela is absolutely crucial in regional terms, and this is also something we've been talking about over many conversations over the past months, because if the United States can get its proxies into power in Venezuela, then the essential motor that has enabled the Cuban Revolution not just to survive the last 10, 15 years, but actually to progress,
right.
and experience economic growth and develop its own economy over the last 15 years, Venezuela has been the motor that has helped Bolivia and Nicaragua and Ecuador to survive the post 2008 crisis recession successfully, and all Bolivia and Nicaragua have they're among the top two or three countries in Latin America according to the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America, right. And the Caribbean, in terms of economic growth, in terms of all right. kinds of indicators, reducing inequality.
Yep.
And that's also true of Venezuela.
That's right.
Despite the crisis of the last couple of years.
Right. I mean, so, you can't buy whatever it is that they're, you know, playing around with this week, whether toilet paper or, laundry soap or whatever. But, by the way, there's 1.5 million new housing units that have come online in the last 5 years, and those things measure into the column of economics as well.
Yeah, and that's why politically, President Nicolas Maduro is on track to win re-election in the presidential right. election scheduled for May the 22nd.
Right.
And, you know, and the in that regional context, if, and should Nicolas Maduro successfully win those presidential elections, and it's not at all clear, and the opposition, the main opposition candidate, Henry Falcon, is going to be able to prevent that. Although Falcon himself, it has to be said, Falcon himself and the right-wing polling companies are projecting a win by 4 or 5 or 6 percentage points for Falcon if right. the elections were held today.
Right.
But and the reality is we've seen in election after election in Venezuela is that right-wing election polls always overstate the case for their projections for the opposition candidates, and they always end up with egg on their face when the results finally come in.
Well, now they're not really. I mean, look, the point of those polls is not to do a scientific analysis for third party use objectively, but rather they're weapons, public relations weapons that are part and parcel of the campaign. That was true here in the United States too. By the way, let's go back to all of the polling data up to like 10 minutes before. The final vote count came in. It showed that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president of the United States. They all said that.
Oh, yeah, but that was the Russians, Don.
Oops.
that ridiculous propaganda, again, the Russians did it. And you, right. you find that cropping up constantly in reporting on Latin America as well, you know. And whereas the mainstream corporate media continually play down the growing influence of China in the region, and they're constantly raising the specter of the Russian manipulation in Venezuela, Russian manipulation in Cuba, for example, and it's like a modern day version of the olden times Red Scares, you know.
That's right. That's right. Well, go ahead. Sorry.
And you still get that also in relation to Nicaragua, for example, because Russia has assisted Nicaragua with its satellite technology, and part of that assistance has been the establishment of a Russian satellite ground station in Nicaragua. And the United States, I think there was an article in the Washington Post in around July, August last year, claiming that this was evidence of Russian military interference in Central America,
right.
And which is laughable when you look at, you know, there's one tiny little Russian satellite ground station somewhere in Nicaragua with maybe 2 or 3 Russian personnel. And all around Nicaragua, there are hundreds and thousands of U.S. military personnel at the military bases in Honduras, in Soto Cano, in Comalapa, in El Salvador. And there, at any given time, there could be thousands of U.S. military personnel in Costa Rica.
And, by the way, all along Russia, too, by the way.
Right. So anyway, and that's... Going back to Venezuela, there'll be an election, a presidential election, also legislative elections, I think, in Venezuela over the next few months, and the presidential elections are going to be separate from the legislative elections. But all the signs are that the current government of Nicolas Maduro will be successful in achieving re-election for President Maduro, and that they're likely to reverse the current opposition majority in the National Assembly. But obviously, time will tell. The other big event happening over the weekend and this weekend is certainly for us here in Nicaragua, is the election in Costa Rica, where there's likely to be very little change, but one never really knows. And the two candidates in the runoff election following the first round elections earlier this year are a candidate, they're both called Alvarado. Carlos Alvarado is the candidate for the ruling party, the PAC, and the guy called Fabricio Alvarado is a more right-wing candidate. and whoever wins that election, in terms of Costa Rica's international policy, that there's likely to be very little change.
Right.
Although there might be some change in domestic policy.
Yeah.
But who knows? We'll just have to see how things pan out. It's possible that if a more right-wing candidate wins in Costa Rica, they may drive with greater determination to incorporate themselves into the Pacific Alliance countries and the countries aligned more insistently with United States government policy across the region, but we don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
The much bigger events in terms of the south of the region are that President Kuczynski has had to resign in Peru as a result of corruption allegations,
right.
And that may have effects on the Americas summit scheduled for the 12th, 13th of April, to which President Trump has said he's going to take part. And also that raises the question of what's going to happen with the participation of Venezuela, and if Venezuela isn't allowed to participate because President Kuczynski, before his resignation, told President Maduro that he wasn't invited, which is unprecedented in terms of regional diplomatic relations.
Really?
Because although the summit of the Americas is hosted by a given country, and that given country is not usually the country that decides who's to be invited, because
right.
and the in years past, Cuba was always denied permission to participate in those kinds of summits, but as of two or three summits ago, and a great majority of Latin American countries insisted that Cuba should participate, and so Cuba's expected to participate, and it'll be interesting to see what happens, because if Peru insists that Venezuela shouldn't participate, what will be the reaction of the other ALBA countries, including
right.
Ecuador, despite its current social democrat
right.
centrist government?
Right.
Even they have said that It's not permissible for Peru to refuse the participation of Venezuela's president. And who knows what's going to happen? We'll see. We've only got a couple of weeks before that happens,
yeah.
And that'll be a very interesting indication of the kind of balance of power within the region in terms of, you know, is the United States able to force its Latin American vassal states to engage in behavior that is essentially very prejudicial to their interests,
yep.
In the same way that they've done with the European Union over Russia, for example.
Right.
And that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
And the other big thing that's been happening over the last couple of weeks has been the case in the International Court of Justice between Bolivia and
right.
Chile, whereby Bolivia is reclaiming its right to access to the Pacific Ocean after well over 100 years of military occupation by Chile of Bolivian territory since the 1879 war. Now, Chile is arguing that a treaty agreed in 1904 between Bolivia and Peru gives it sovereign rights over the territory that it conquered back in 1879. And Bolivia's saying that whatever the rights and wrongs of that treaty, and Chile has an obligation to negotiate Bolivia's sovereign access to the Pacific Ocean. So the legal arguments, the detail of the legal arguments is quite complicated. But essentially, Bolivia's saying that Chile has to negotiate sovereign access to the sea on the basis of a whole series of precedents
right.
over the last 100 years.
Right.
And Chile is saying that it has no obligation to negotiate. And the case in the ICJ, the International Court of Justice in The Hague, is, you know, will they tell Bolivia, will they order Chile to negotiate or not?
Right. Yeah, so, you've got also the situation in Brazil with Lula still, yeah. And we're getting close to time here, but it appears that all stops are being pulled to try to prevent him from running for president, because if he does, he'll win, including he's been doing a march across the country that was attacked violently over the past week.
Yeah, in the south of the country, which is predominantly right wing, and the caravana, as they call it, right. of Ignacio Lula da Silva's attempts to mobilize support for his presidential candidacy in the July, I think they're in July, late July or early August elections, presidential elections in Brazil, was attacked and actually fired at. Which is absolutely right. Unprecedented. Now, it was shot at by it's a three-vehicle caravan, and the first two vehicles, in which thankfully Lula da Silva was not traveling, were hit by gunfire.
Right.
Even President Temer, the usurper president in Brazil at the moment, he was moved to condemn
right.
those violent attacks. The nitty gritty there is that, and as we talked about it over many conversations previously, the judicialization of politics has come to the point in Brazil, as in Argentina and elsewhere, right. where evidence doesn't matter. There's no hard evidence on which to base the sentence that was handed down by Brazil's courts against Lula da Silva
right.
For corruption. There's absolutely no hard evidence. It's all based on supposition.
Right.
Supposition. Now, the legally, his lawyers have presented a habeas corpus case, which, if it's successful in a judgment on April the 4th, if the Supreme Court rules that submission from Lula's defense lawyers has merit, then he will be able to be a candidate in the presidential elections. And if they rule against that, then he won't.
And we'd like to thank you. And next week we can pick up there and also look at Argentina, where the reaction to the regime imposed by similar game playing is taking place in the streets over public sector layoffs. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Okay, and you, Don. Look forward to talking to you.
Me too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. Haiti, battered by natural disasters, is reeling from a scandal around the revelations of abuse by international aid workers. How will it affect the humanitarian efforts of NGOs and the UN in the country? Well, I ask Azili Danto, Haitian human rights lawyer.
Haiti, a country that is still recovering from earthquakes and hurricanes, while coping with rampant poverty and a drastic lack of infrastructure, has drawn sympathy from across the globe, with NGOs and UN agencies rushing to help the battered nation. But with revelations of corruption and abuse by UN and aid workers, has the image of the charitable organizations been tainted for good? Will the Haitian government expel the groups from the country altogether? And can it handle its problems all alone?
Azili Danto, Haitian human rights lawyer, welcome. It's really great to have you on our program. Lots to talk about. Now, the latest scandal in Haiti is over Oxfam employees engaging in sexual exploitations in the country. The Haitian government has suspended the work of the UK charity. Oxfam has apologized, started an investigation, and fired those responsible. What more could they do right now?
Well, I think Oxfam is just sort of the symptom of the problem, because Haiti's under occupation and these NGOs are there masturbating on this pain that has been imposed upon us because of imperialism. What else could they do? They could actually leave Haiti.
Okay, we're going to go actually case by case, but because Oxfam is the latest case. I'd like to focus on that in the beginning. I mean, it only takes one scandal to ruin the reputation of a charity. Accusations stick and people start thinking that the whole organization is rotten. After the scandal broke out, Oxfam CEO said that everything the organization tried to say or do just fueled the fires of public opinion. It's like no matter what they say, it won't come out right. Do they really deserve to be battered further?
Well, yes. We're talking about children. We're talking about post-earthquake. I mean, look at the situation, Sophie. We're talking about 2010, the catastrophic apocalyptic earthquake that killed over 310,000 Haitians, that made over 2 million Haitians homeless. And then you have this army of NGOs coming in, and that's where Oxfam comes in with a director who has been recycled in different other NGOs as a sexual, immoral person. I mean, he's actually, he was in Liberia and fired by a British NGO in Liberia in 2004, this Roland person. And then he was recruited by Oxfam. And he had what they, I mean, it's so nasty what he was doing. Caligula sex. That's bestiality. That's orgies with people who have lost everything and are looking at these charitable organizations as
their saviors.
Folks that have come to help them.
As
saviors, yes. Yeah. And this is not just Oxfam. We have the UN doing the same thing. So
we're going to talk about the UN
of foreigners coming in.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the UN further down in our interview. So only the UK division of Oxfam has been banned. Other Oxfam workers are still in Haiti. Does that mean that the country actually needs Oxfam here, or just found a temporary scapegoat in the UK division?
We Haitians have not been heard. This is not about Oxfam. This is about the underage children who were used by this NGO, who are now being blared about in headlines as prostitutes. What happens when you're 15 years old and your mother just died? Five of your brothers just died. And instead of helping you with the donation dollars that's paying this man's salary, that's been given by citizens of the world who care about what happened, this crisis, this man held orgy sex with animals, with these children. What can happen to them? I'm a human rights lawyer who spent the last 24 years of my life since 1994 exposing that the charitable industrial complex and the military industrial complex are about colonialism, that they're in Haiti as a smokescreen while the Western corporatocracy takes our resources out. So, you know, you're talking to a Haitian woman. You're not talking to, like, an NGO person.
I know, and it's very emotional. I mean, I do realize that, but me as a journalist, I need to make sure that I cover all sides, so bear with me, because I'm going to have to ask you these questions, but I need your answers. Guardian wrote that foreigners pay more money to sex workers, a lot more than the locals. I know it sounds gross, but in some way, could these encounters have been voluntary? So locals may have a role in this too, not just Oxfam? Could that be a possibility as well?
Well, Oxfam is an NGO, which is a non-governmental organization, which is given its accreditation by the United Nations. The United Nations has a policy against having sex with your beneficiaries. So does Oxfam. And so we're talking about a situation where you're asking me, is the victim? And we're talking about underage folks here. This man that we're talking about, Roland, has a history of having sex in places paid by donation dollars. As the he started out in Liberia and he was dismissed for having sex with local people, including underage children. And, you know, as a lawyer, as a human rights lawyer, I'm actually concerned. sex with underage children is pedophilia. It's a crime. We're not talking about anything else. Yes, there's prostitution. But as you know, whenever a military comes into a space, the level of sexual abuse and prostitution goes up at least 15%. Is that really what the UN and the NGOs are supposed to be doing in Haiti? Aren't they supposed to be fiduciaries that are given this position as philanthropists and humanitarian to not to bring up the level of prostitutions in Haiti, but to help Haiti develop, to provide help at a time of crisis? I mean, an apocalyptic crisis when everything has fallen down. So no, I reject the idea that the Haitian women and men who were victims of Oxfam are to blame for any of what happened with regards to that, because you're talking about a differential in power.
Yeah.
And we're talking about underage girls. And when we're talking about underage girls or underage boys, we're talking about a crime. The age in Haiti is 18 for maturity. So although the media wants to make these underage children prostitutes, who really is the whore here? Who really is the criminal here?
So Haitian Parliament has learned that the majority of abuse cases don't get reported. Oxfam actually has the reporting requirements in place. Their stats are transparent. Other agencies don't have those requirements. So do you have any information about their transgressions?
You know, I had the Free Haiti Movement, which I founded in 2004 when the United Nations lent its uniforms to this occupation, where it's this humanitarian front is covering up the corporate plunder of Haiti's riches. I had something called the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, which I founded in 1994, 24 years ago. And the purpose was to institutionalize the rule of law and to protect and defend the cultural, human, and economic rights of Haitians living at home and abroad. Now, the question you're asking me is there a reporting requirement with regards to the NGOs and what they're doing in Haiti? The NGOs do whatever they want in Haiti. Remember, there's a level of racism and a level of when you're under occupation and these NGOs come in, they're making so much more money than, let's say, a Haitian lawyer in Haiti, a native Haitian lawyer in Haiti, who is going to fight on behalf of, let's say, the victims. So you're talking about a disparity of power. You're talking about this idea that these white folks, like Oxfam's director, who was fired, and the other, I think they fired, Oxfam fired three executive and another four. They let them resign. They let three resign, and then they fired for gross misconduct three. So, but they never reported to the Haitian government that says it's a crime to have sex with minors. They never reported that, so they concealed it. And they continue to conceal what was going on. Up until now, 8 years later, we hear about it.
We're going to take a short break right now.
Okay.
And when we're back, we'll continue talking to Ezelie Danto, human rights lawyer, discussing the humanitarian missions in Haiti and the uproar they have been causing. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Ezelie Danto, Haitian human rights lawyer, discussing the controversy around aid missions in Haiti. So now the Haitian president, after an investigation, is calling the Oxfam affair the tip of the iceberg. But on the other hand, can the Haitian government really afford to poke into other aid groups besides Oxfam? President mentioned investigated Médecins Sans Frontières and other NGOs. What if more organizations are suspended? Can they manage without them? Can Haiti do without NGOs altogether?
You know, I want your audience to hear me when I say this. You can't develop a country with charity. You cannot. the charities are there in Haiti to assist with the symptoms of the problem, not the root of the problem of Haiti. And that's symptoms. Like when you have no clean water, no health care, no infrastructure, those are all symptoms of a greater problem in Haiti. And that greater problem is imperialism. That greater problem is debt, dependency, and domination that Haiti has had to deal with since it became the first free republic ruled by black people since 1804. So we've had to deal with this imperialism that comes in and takes out Haiti's resources. So here is the answer. The answer for your audience to understand is not charity. It's not these NGOs. It's not Oxfam. You take someone's agency away when you bring in foreigners and you have those foreigners give you public services like clean water, like health care. They're not accountable. That's why you have the problem of Oxfam. That's why you have the larger problem of the UN troops and their sex rings and their cholera that has gotten to Haiti and all of the travesties that we've had to suffer directly since 2004 when the UN came in. And they came in, the UN came in after the United States, France, and Canada and the Western powers ousted through a Bush regime change in 2004, the democratically elected president of Haiti, which I used to represent. So we're talking about the UN and the charitable workers who come in to cover that this is an occupation. Because if it was acknowledged openly that this is a humanitarian front to occupation, then the public of these various nations would oppose it. But if you say Haiti needs charity and look at these Haitians and all their problems and you say these things all the time, this is what they say about Haiti. We are the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
Sorry, so why can't you just guys kick them out? I don't understand. It's not like they're there by force, right? Someone is certainly inviting them. Why can't you just be like, we don't need you. Bye. What is the problem?
As I said, the UN came in 2004 after the United States, France, and Canada and their deep state CIA agents helped take down the democratically elected president. What we have in Haiti right now is an occupation, a military occupation, with the UN serving as proxy military.
Are you saying your government is in conspiracy with the United Nations? Because no organization, including United
yes.
Nations, can be on a territory of a country without a consensus of the government of that country.
After the earthquake, we had Bill and Hillary Clinton essentially take over Haiti and take over the aid to Haiti. They raised
13.3 billion. Why do you think they're so interested in Haiti? Why such interest on behalf of the Clintons in your country? Why?
I am so happy you asked, because Haiti lies between two nations that the United States want to become client states, that they dislike, that has not fallen into a line with manifest destiny and the Monroe Doctrine and so on. That's Cuba and Venezuela. We are right in between. We are that weakest link in that horseshoe. Also, this is what we say at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, which I lead. We say that the United Nations forces in Haiti are the AFRICOM of the Western Hemisphere. They are the U.S. Western military arm training Latin American and Central American soldiers on behalf of the Western powers. And they use Haiti as a training ground. That's number one. Number two, Haiti has massive oil. The head of Venezuelan's oil is in Haiti's waters. In terms of riches, Haiti has, they say now, $20 billion in gold. Haitian geologist says it's $100 billion in gold. During the earthquake, Bill and Hillary Clinton put in through fake elections, and you can see this, just Google it, Michel Martelly, who was a former carnival singer, If you look at the emails from Hillary and Bill Clinton, they show you that they created this fake election. And now in 2016, we have, 2017, we have this new president, Jovenel Moïse. Jovenel Moïse was handpicked by Michel Martelly, who was put into office by Bill and Hillary Clinton under the Obama administration.
Azali, and now the aid groups and UN agencies, they always stress that they're doing a lot of good. They do outstrip the bad that happens. But good rarely makes for a hot news story. That always goes unnoticed. So all the good work they could be doing, because I'm sure they are doing something good, emergency aid, medication, shelter, supplies, etc., will that always be outweighed by the bad behavior, by the scandals, by the overall problem of the occupation that you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. So no matter what they do, even if sometimes they're really actually reaching out and helping people, and that is also an undeniable fact.
Well, as I said before, Sophie, no matter how well-intentioned some these NGOs are, and some of the charitable industrial complex folks are not predators, no matter what their intentions are, we're talking about an occupation. We're talking about imperialism. We're talking about the people of Haiti being disenfranchised by fake elections run by the UN right now on behalf of the United Nations, of the United States and its European allies.
But I just want to ask you about the technicality. Does the humanitarian aid that they bring into your country actually reach people on the ground? Those who really need it, do they get it?
I think the figures were $13.3 billion that was raised after the earthquake. And I think they said that less than 1% of that went to the Haitian government. Most of that money went back to the donors, to their hands. Most of it stayed in the donor hands. To
what?
To bring employment to their people.
To make money off of it? Is that what you're saying?
To bring employment to people like Roland Hammer, whatever his name is,
yeah.
The head of the Oxfam person.
Yeah. Are you going to, by the way,
yeah.
testify?
Well, you already, I think you know that foreign aid cripples most African nations. I think you already know that the statistics say that the World Bank puts out a lot of loans, but the corporate plunder is greater than the aid they ever give to the black nations or to the global south.
A lot of people think the same.
Facts.
I actually spoke to Afghanistan's former president, and he thinks the same way, too. He feels like the foreign aid in the long run is ruining his country because it never comes with no strings attached. So, you know this rapper, I'm sure you know, because he ran for your country's president, Van Cleef Jean. His charity is reported to have spent 25% of money donated on expenses like travel, conferences, accommodation, salaries. How can people who want to help donate be sure that their money goes where it has to? Because you don't necessarily need to be part of UN or Médecins Sans Frontières or other NGO to want to help, right? There are a lot of philanthropists who want to help. Yeah, like you're sitting in your house, you're watching, there's an earthquake, you want to donate money. How do you make sure that it gets where it has to be?
Right. Well, you see, I'm still thinking that we're having the wrong conversation here. Charity cannot develop a nation. It can't give it infrastructure, healthcare. It can only allow for dependency. And you mentioned one charity, which is Wyclef Jean. Wyclef Jean is like a tiny little bit of so small compared to the Clinton Global Initiative and the big NGOs and what they're doing in Haiti. The Red Cross raised $500 million in Haiti after the earthquake and only built 7 homes and left no infrastructure. And we need clean water, just basic clean water they could have given us with that $13.3 billion that was raised. Because the UN in 2010, as you know, brought us cholera, which has killed over 10,000 Haitians and made sick more than, they say a million, I say 3 million Haitians. So we don't even have clean water. So what do these 42,000 NGOs have to show except the fact that they are used as a smokescreen
for media? I wasn't referring to NGOs to focus right now. I was just talking about people who want to help. Do I understand you correctly that your message to my audience is that anyone who is watching TV and their calls to help Haiti, they shouldn't? Is that what you're saying? Haiti?
Yes. What I'm saying is if Haiti cannot be developed by charity, if anyone wants to help Haiti, you need to help us get rid of the U.S. occupation hidden by U.N. mercenary guns, fake aid, fake election, fake a charity. That's what we want as Haitians. And for instance, after the earthquake, we started, my organization, the ESLI Network, because we were not getting help, because the people were being given dirty water by the NGOs, we started a program, Zili Dlo, which gives clean water. It's a very tiny project, but it is Haiti-led, Haiti-run, and it transfers skills to Haitian without a middleman. Those are the type of projects that people who are interested in helping Haiti can do. Assist an indigenous, Haiti-led, Haiti capacity-building organization, not an organization that's building up the capacity of the NGOs.
All right. It was really interesting insight to hear from you, Azalee, actually. Thanks for this interview. I've never heard someone speak so passionately about the country and speak the way you speak about the country. I wish you all the best in your future endeavors. Azalee Danteau, we were talking to the Haitian human rights lawyer about the UN and other groups' humanitarian efforts in Haiti and why they've drawn so much criticism. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.